This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba through the hour talking with you about what's new in healthy living, sharing some down-to-earth advice and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. Want to talk with Zorba? Give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, some interesting research to kick around during the hour?
Yes, some study looking at teenage pregnancy rates, abstinence, contraceptive use, which one is superior, how does that affect our society? We'll talk a little bit about it. Interesting study.
Okay, and?
FDA looking at cold remedies for children and whether or not they should start to pull back and tell mothers and fathers that they shouldn't be using them. When you look at the cold remedy market, it's huge. It's a multi-billion dollar market. There are a lot of players here. Let's look at the data.
We have our medical myth buster coming up and a good recipe.
Yes, maple oat griddle cakes. So we've got a breakfast recipe that is heart healthy.
I think Adam is fixing those for us, too.
You bet.
We'll
get
be
a chance
breakfast
to taste it on the air.
About 25 minutes or so. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. 1-800-462-7413. And a listener with us now, Zorba, in Spokane, Washington. Hi.
Hey, guys. How are you guys doing?
Fine. How can we help you?
Well, I got a quick question for you. Let me give you a little background first.
Sure.
I used to work out a lot in the morning, and I liked that a lot because it gave me a lot of energy. It felt like, anyway, that pushed me through part of the day and good appetite and everything. And then, but now I've got a couple kids, and so now I've been forced to work out at night, 8:30 at night, 9 and 10 o'clock at night, like that, which is good too, because I get to feel like I'm working out some frustrations and, you know, things like stress.
Sure.
But my question is there an advantage to working out in the morning versus the evening? Because, you know, once you get done working out at night, you shower up, watch a little TV, and then you just go straight to bed. So is there an advantage of one over the other?
Not really. Really, I'll tell you, there's some interesting studies that look at people who exercise in the morning and people who exercise in the evening. And one thing in many, many studies that appears to come out is that morning exercisers tend to continue with their exercise more than evening exercisers. In other words, maybe it's a motivational thing. If you exercise in the morning, you're just more likely to keep with your routine. But there's no evidence that one is superior to the other. Now, for some people, they exercise in the evening and it wakes them up a lot. Do you find that you're too sort of woken up in the evening after you exercise?
Not really. I was a little afraid of that. But like I said, I sit down and watch a little TV, and that just kind of, you know, numbs the mind and everything.
Numbs the mind, yeah. before you go to sleep. So how old are your kids?
2 and 4.
And then when you exercise, what do you do in the evening? What sort of routine do you have?
Usually, it kind of varies. But anything from going running outside. In Spokane, you know, I've got some, you know, good warm clothes for running outside and stuff. And,
Of course.
I also got my bike on a trainer, so I can pedal on that. Got, you know, free weights and stuff like that,
right,
too.
And the whole idea is that doing it sometime in your day is really what counts. And it's hard, you know, here it is. You know, you're working, you've got young children, you've got lots of responsibilities. Like you say, you've got frustrations that occur throughout the day. And exercise can be an excellent way to sort of take yourself and free yourself from those frustrations. Evening exercise, just as good as morning exercise. You get the same value. And the idea is just to stick with it. And that's the challenge, is you have children and more stuff to do.
Do you consider yourself a morning person or a night person?
You know, with kids now, you have to kind of be both. You have to go as well, you know. I used to be a morning person. And I think, I don't know if it's a biorhythm thing or what, but I think you can change.
That's interesting, because I'm very much a morning person, have been all my life, and I can't even conceive of exercise at night. I kind of start out on a kind of an energy high early in the morning, and by the time it gets to evening, I'm just too worn out to exercise. You don't find that, though, obviously.
I didn't say I was very consistent with my evening exercise, but it's not bad. It's not bad. You know, you just, like you guys were kind of saying, there's a nice little relief. You know, this is my time a little bit.
That's it. I think you hit it right there. This is my time. This is what I'm doing, and I'm exercising now. And sometimes that's the most important thing, that, especially when you've got a family and family responsibilities. It's a matter of saying, this is my time. I'm exercising now. And that's okay. It's okay to take and put your space around that so you've got space for yourself.
Yeah, you mentioned wanting to numb your mind after exercise in the evening. Don't listen to public radio. That won't numb your mind.
Not at all. Thanks for your call.
Thank you guys very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. A listener with us now, Zorba, in Mamaroneck, New York. Hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine. How can we help you?
Well, I did a lot of research on a parasite called H. pylori. My son was away at college in Albany and came home from college and was down about 35 pounds total by the time I got a handle on what was going on.
Ooh.
So we did a lot of testing with the specialist long before we found out what it was, and it was just perchance that when they did the endoscopy, they did a culture and found this. So I was informed that 75% of the world's population has this, but the specialist from Greenwich said that he had never in all of his years of practice seen it in a 20-year-old young man.
Hmm.
So he told me it was a foodborne parasite, and the only way to cure it was to take very heavy doses of something called PrevPak, which was a 15-day course of very strong antibiotics and Prevacid. Now, my question is, where does it come from? Why don't we hear more about it? And what can be done to get my son back on track, because the 15-day course of antibiotic was not selective. It just doesn't kill the parasite. It kills everything in the body.
Let me set a few things straight, first of all. The guy who actually discovered H. pylori, which is not a parasite, by the way, it's a bacterium. Parasites are different. Actually got the Nobel Prize for this, and he was very interesting because he was Australian, and it was about the mid-70s, and he said, you know, I think ulcers are caused by infections, and everyone said, no, it's not. And so, you know, he was doing research and stuff, and this is a funny little bacteria. It's hard to actually find it. No one actually found it until the 70s, and I don't know how he discovered it through staining techniques, and said, I think that's it. Grew it. And then actually swallowed it himself. He took it himself.
Oh, gosh.
And then had somebody do an endoscopy and took it. Lo and below, I mean, he actually developed an ulcer. Then no one still believed him. So he then went around the world presenting this data, trying to convince people. It's a strange story that this bacterium were actually causing an ulcer. And it turns out it's a very common bacteria in many countries. I don't think it's 75%, but a lot of people are infected with this bacteria at a young age. So a lot of young people will say, certainly in developing countries, actually have this. They get it from other people. It's spread from other people. For many people, it does not cause an ulcer. And for many people, it does cause an ulcer. The treatment is very effective. It's not actually heavy-duty antibiotics. They're actually commonly used antibiotics, but you can't use one. You have to use two. And there are several different treatment models. One uses actually Prevacid, which reduces acid. Another actually uses high doses of Pepto-Bismol with it. Mm. But you need two antibiotics to cure it. And the cure rate is not 100%. The cure rate is only about 80, 85%. So it turns out that some people need a second course of antibiotics, either the same antibiotics or a different one. Has your son gained weight, though? What's happening with his weight?
Well, I think he's up about 5 pounds, which is a good thing.
That's a good sign. That's a good sign. When did he finish his treatment?
About 3 weeks ago.
Okay. Okay.
If he is eating. He does have an appetite.
If he's eating and he's gained weight, chances are much more likely than not that he actually is a cure. Chances are 85 or 90%. I mean, that's pretty high. Mm. And if he goes back to his normal weight, I think you're fine. I don't think he needs to be scoped again. But if he continues with pain, continuous symptoms, he does need to be re-scoped.
Yeah. Interesting topic. Thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. Do you have a question for Zorba? Give us a call. 1-800-462-7413. You mentioned, Zorba, new research on a controversy that's been going on for a long time, abstinence versus safe sex in sex education. What's this new stuff all about?
Well, you know, when we look at sex, sex education, and how society treats it, I mean, this is something that always has cultural issues. When I first moved to Wisconsin several decades ago, it was illegal to say the word condom in public, and it was illegal to show a condom at a lecture when I went to college at the University of Wisconsin.
I don't think that's right.
Absolutely
illegal?
It wasn't illegal.
Against the law.
It was illegal and against the law, and I can remember I went to a group where we brought somebody who was discussing condoms, and she held it up and she said, "This is a condom, arrest me." Well, of course, nobody arrested her, and the law fell to the wayside, but it shows you. Huh. And back in the 50s in Wisconsin, it was illegal to have a vasectomy. Vasectomies were covered under the same rules as abortion. A vasectomy was considered an abortion in the 50s. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I want to just give that into a perspective that this is nothing new.
Right.
This is something that's been going on for a long time. Now, in our present sort of climate, what has happened is there are no government programs where safe sex is discussed, essentially. It's only abstinence. Abstinence, and nothing else. Now, there's been a drop in the teenage pregnancy rate, a major drop. This was a study from the American Journal of Public Health, and the teenage pregnancy rate from 95 to 2002. Mm-hmm. Okay, so 95 to 2002. All right. Basically, we look at before this abstinence issue and afterwards, and what they looked at is what drop has occurred, and there's a 38% drop in the pregnancy rate. When they look back to see what that drop is it from abstinence? And the answer is only 14% of the decline is because fewer teens are having sex. 86% of the decline is because teens who are having sex are using birth control.
Hmm.
They know about it. It's available. There are better forms of birth control. They're able to use it. It has to do with the fact that they're now using birth control.
You could make the case that that's because we don't have enough abstinence sex education going on, and that the decline in teen pregnancy could be even greater if we had a greater emphasis on abstinence.
Right. Yeah, and you can always look at that and say that that's a possibility, and it absolutely is, except there has been no significant decline. Abstinence is still, as I said, 14% of the drop in rate, and frankly, the government is spending $40, $50 million a year on abstinence-only
education.
Right now,
the federal government requires abstinence to be a part of any sex education
program. But I think that you can argue that what we really need, at least from my point of view, what you really need is the fact that, and discussing abstinence, I think, and discussing not having sex before marriage, I think, is an excellent thing to discuss and should be part of the program. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
And in fact, there's a lot that's right with that from sort of an ethical, moral, society point
sure.
of view. But leaving out the contraceptive point of view, to me, is just plain dumb that you have to discuss contraceptives because teenagers often don't understand contraceptives and how they work, especially the group that's the young group that clearly engages in sexual relations between the ages of 15 and 19. So I think you have to put that from a medical point of view.
The concern, though, is that the more you talk about condoms, the more kids are going to have sex. If you more heavily emphasized abstinence, that would keep kids.
Uh-huh. But the problem is there's no scientific evidence behind that. In other words, even with the increase in abstinence-only education that has been developed, there's been no significant drop in the number of teenagers who are actually having sex across the country. In other words, if you've been supporting this for the last 5 or 6 years and you haven't seen a drop in the number of teens who are having sex, then it shows that the education is working. It's not doing anything. And studies have shown that abstinence only has not produced a significant drop in teen sex, which I think is an ethical moral issue, but it hasn't worked.
800-462-7413, toll free, 1-800-462-7413. To Jacksonville, Florida we go now. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, what's up?
Well, I have an elbow issue.
Ooh.
I have on the insides of my elbows, if you were to face your palms up, mm-hmm. on the inside of both arms, the elbow, over about the last year and a half, it just stays constantly, constantly sore to the touch. And my hands and my forearms began going numb, and well, not really numb, but asleep numb and tingling, you know, at just different periods when I was holding the phone or if I'd been on the keyboard a lot. Eventually, it got to the point where it was like 70% of the day they were. And it was waking me up at night.
Wow.
And
wow.
I can't figure mm-hmm. out. There's no pain.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's just this numbness that occurs. What do you do for a living?
I'm a manager at a utility company.
So you're at the computer all the time?
Yeah, probably about 3 to 4 hours a day.
3 to 4 hours a day with that. What happens on the weekend when you go on vacation? What happens to this numbness?
Same thing.
Okay, so it doesn't, and you're not, obviously not, I assume you're not on the computer 3 to 4 hours a day, although some people are.
No, maybe a little bit, but not that much.
So when you're on the vacation. More when you sleep at night, during the daytime, when does it bother you the most?
It seemed to be, it woke me up a great deal at night. So I would say probably more heavily during the nighttime.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now,
okay.
I did start wearing the little elbow supports, little stretchy bands.
Sure. What did that do, the neoprene?
It has helped.
Okay,
it really has. With that. The soreness is not as bad, and they don't go numb quite as much.
Well, one of the ways to find out what this is, there is, you have something called the crazy bone. It's not really a crazy bone. It's a nerve, obviously, around the elbow that's rather superficial. And that particular nerve, at times, when it's pushed on, just like in the carpal tunnel when we have the nerve, when it's pushed on, the nerve that's in the carpal tunnel, you can have this numbness and tingling. And an EMG, that's a test where they put tiny little needles, not really too painful, and they look at electrical charges as they go down the arm. The EMG will help tell whether or not this essentially is an ulnar nerve problem, because that's what it sounds like. It sounds to me like this may be an ulnar nerve problem. And then the treatment may be just what you're doing, but actually sometimes they actually take the nerve, take it, and move it into a slightly different spot along the elbow. One of the things that happens is people can get this when they take their elbow and they are putting pressure on their elbow around what we call our crazy bone. So you're putting pressure around that nerve. So I would look at whether or not when you're sitting in chair, if you're watching television, when you're driving a car, when you're sitting at your desk, are you putting pressure on your elbow that's actually causing this? Follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
And sometimes if you put a pillow on a chair so you sit higher, your elbows are on the armrest differently. Sometimes if you're sitting at the kitchen table, if you have a chair with an armrest, you take the armrest away, you're not putting your armrest at the kitchen table. Same with a television. Same with the way you're driving your car. You may be resting your elbow. I used to have this trouble because I would rest my elbow on the armrest on the door. There's a little armrest kind of on a door. And
exactly.
I discovered when I did it on the armrest, I had this problem, and I stopped doing it. I hold the wheel now with both hands, and my numbness went away.
Oh my.
So you want to look at your crazy bone. That's how I'm identifying it. That's that nerve. And wear these pads and see what it is. And if that doesn't work, well, if it does work, you've got your answer.
Right.
It's there. If it doesn't work, you need an EMG to see what's going on.
You said crazy bone. Is that the same as funny bone?
Yeah, funny bone, crazy bone. Your mother called it the funny bone?
Funny bone, yeah.
Oh, my mother called it the crazy bone.
I don't know. Funny bone's always.
Yeah, funny bone. See, funny bone, crazy bone.
Yeah.
See, that's it. Well, obviously, it must be a Chicago thing. So. Thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, speaking of aching arms, Zorba, you'll remember we were talking about carpal tunnel with a caller not long ago. You advised the caller to alter the typing position. Well, here's a listener tip from Margaret in St. Louis, Missouri. See what you think. Margaret says that she, too, suffered from carpal tunnel. She discovered it was the constant use of her computer mouse that was causing it, so she quickly developed a simple solution. She taught herself how to use her mouse with her offhand and now switches hands throughout her workday. What do you think?
I think it's a great idea. It's a great idea. You know, mouse issues are big issues when it comes to disability.
I'd be concerned that she would then develop carpal tunnel in the other.
No, what happens is we're right or we're left dominant usually, and what happens is we then go back to our usual one hand. But you're right. That would be something you would be concerned about, whether or not using the other arm and the other hand would do the same thing. On the other hand, it often just means that you're not spending 100% of the time with that. The other issue is there are trackballs. There are a different type of a mouse. Instead of that, some people like that. They're big ones and small ones. They're large trackballs and small trackballs, and all these things, when we work in them, can make a difference in terms of essentially how this mouse disability occurs. It's a common problem. The more computers we use, essentially, the more we use the mouse. So congratulations. Also, think about an ergonomic keyboard. The ergonomic keyboards can also make a difference.
Right. So. We enjoy your listener tips. Just send them along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have a recipe coming up, a breakfast recipe this time around. Lots more of your calls, some more research. We have our medical myth buster. Lots of good reasons to stick around here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Want to talk with Zorba? Here's the number to call, 800-462-7413. And we will get back to the phones right after our recipe, which is coming up right now. Maple oat griddle cakes.
Yes, breakfast. Breakfast griddle cakes. Do you like griddle cakes? Do you like
pancakes? Sure.
Cakes? You bet. You bet. Yeah. I always think of them.
Right next to me is a plate of these with bananas
I know,
on top
difficult.
That Adam put together.
Right. Adam put together. It's dynamite.
Adam,
it's hard.
Adam, where are the sausages? Anyway.
There's always one in every crowd. Yeah. Okay, let's talk about this. One of the things you can do about this that's kind of nice is you can take the dry ingredients, mix them together, put them in a Ziploc bag or put them in a plastic container and just always have them so you don't have to make them up.
Oh, so be a really quick, easy breakfast.
Right. Oh, in other words, you can make your own instant maple oat griddle cakes. You know how you buy things that are prepackaged? You can prepackage your dry ingredients when you want them. You just take them out.
Ooh, what a neat idea.
Yeah. Which is good. So start out with 1 cup of all-purpose flour.
A cup of all-purpose flour.
Right, and that's just regular flour. The better for bread flour is a high-gluten flour. You can use that, but the all-purpose is really better.
Okay.
A quarter cup of flaxseed meal.
Quarter cup of flaxseed meal.
Now, flaxseed has good oil. It is a whole grain.
Yeah.
And it's a meal, which means it's sort of, it means it's the whole grain of flaxseed, and it adds fiber to the diet.
Okay.
It's, it's good stuff.
Okay.
I start out with a quarter cup of instant oats.
A quarter cup of instant oats.
That's right, because oats, often when you buy oats, if they're regular rolled oats without anything there, they have to be cooked. They have to be cooked for 20 minutes or 25 minutes. Instant oats are then processed so that as soon as you add hot water, they basically begin to expand. So you need instant oats for this.
All right.
1.5 teaspoons of baking powder.
A teaspoon and a half
of
baking powder.
That's right. Baking powder is what causes it to rise. Mm-hmm. 1/2 teaspoon of baking soda.
1/2 tea baking soda.
1/2 teaspoon of salt.
1/2 tea salt.
And 1/2 teaspoon of cinnamon.
1/2 tea cinnamon.
Okay, so you can mix this all together, and you can put that in a nice little one of those plastic containers,
and you've
got it.
Yeah.
Okay, now, so take that and then add 1 1/4 cups of soy milk.
1 1/4 cups of soy milk.
That's right. So this is good for anyone who's on a lactose-free diet. Soy milk is also delicious once you get used to it.
Mm-hmm.
It has a different taste. It doesn't taste exactly like milk. I noticed that you're giving sort of a squint with your mouth thinking.
I mean, could you use regular milk?
You could use regular milk, yes. But I am going to use soy milk because I'm going to use the politically correct part of this recipe, which is soy milk.
If you used regular and used skim
you would use low-fat. That's exactly it.
Yeah.
You would use 1% or skim. Right. Milk or 2%. You would not use whole milk because it has more fat.
Yeah.
But if you go to soy milk, you avoid all saturated fat. And there's an advantage to that, especially if people are on a heart disease diet.
Okay.
1/4 cup of pure maple syrup.
1/4 cup of pure maple syrup.
That's the most expensive part of the recipe.
That's in the recipe in addition to syrup on top?
That's what you're going to use for your sweetness, pure maple syrup.
Yep.
An egg. And a cooking spray, which
basically
is
the pan. Right. Okay.
So, and you're going to use a Teflon pan. So here's how we make it. Mm-hmm. Blend the flour, a flaxseed meal or ground flaxseed if you want to, the oats, a baking powder, baking soda, salt, and cinnamon in a medium bowl. Okay, so you've got it all together. Those are all the dry ingredients. As I said, you can keep them to the side. Then whisk in the soy milk, maple syrup, and egg in a separate bowl. Then add the wet mixture to the dry ingredients and whisk briefly. Remember, you want it to be lumpy. You don't want to over stir it. Then spray a large griddle with cooking spray or brush it with a little oil. Then heat it to medium heat. Make sure it's hot. Then add the batter to the griddle about 1/4 cup full at a time. Cook for 2 minutes until the bubbles appear. Then flip. Cook an additional 2 minutes until golden brown and transfer to the plate. Make sure that it's hot enough to do that and serve with some maple syrup or fresh fruit. I noticed that you look like you're having multiple mouthfuls of this.
These are great.
These are great. These
are good recipes, Zorba. Good job of cooking them.
This is a great recipe. Each griddle cake is only 99 calories, which makes it not very much at all in terms of a cake. So it's 99 calories per griddle cake. Calories from fat are about 20%, but it's only 2 grams of calories for each griddle cake. So this is a good recipe. You know, I mean, it's not something for every day. But if you're going to have it, it's a way to make griddle cakes.
The one caveat,
delicious.
We have to figure out a way that Adam can be at the same time behind the glass and cooking these things up.
That's
because
right.
when they sit for a few minutes,
right.
They get a little on the cold side. Aren't they good?
Oh, this is great.
Delicious. Yeah.
Oh, it's like a chewy.
I turned that plate over to you much too soon. You're going to get nine tenths of these things. I got two bites.
I'm having a second one. These are good. Yeah, you don't get this back. You do not get this back.
Well, we're happy to send you this recipe. You're going to want to cook this one up. These are great. And the idea of prepackaging most of the dry ingredients ahead of time so
makes
you can
it
make these
easier.
Well, just address your request to Zorba. It's hard to talk with your mouth full. Address your request to Zorba Pasture and Your Health, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin. The zip is 53706. Be sure, though, to enclose a business-sized self-addressed stamped envelope so we can send this recipe right back to you.
Or come to our website at zorbapastor.org.
Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413. So if you have a question for Zorba, that's the number to call. A listener now, Zorba, in Neola, Utah. Hi.
Hello.
What's up?
I was just wondering if foods like walnuts can affect your hormones or your mood. My sister told me to stop eating walnuts because nuts make me nuts. So she doesn't let me eat them anymore.
Nuts make you nuts. Well, wait a minute. Now, in what way? What does she think?
I'm just saying they make me angry, like, for no reason. I can just be in a bad mood. Usually I'm pretty cheerful, happy-go-lucky. But if I eat a lot of, I love walnuts and all kinds of nuts. But if I eat them, it makes me angry.
Oh, so you agree with your sister on this thing?
Yeah, I agree with my sister because I think I picked it up a few years ago. Since every time I'd eat them a few hours later, I would be, like, angry. But nothing. I mean, I just feel angry, not be really angry at somebody. But
You know, nuts are interesting foods. They're very high caloric foods. They have omega-3 fatty acids, so they have good oil. They have the good oil that we like. Walnuts, pistachios, anything other than a peanut, which is not a nut. It's a legume. And they're good for us. But I've never seen any evidence about nuts and mood. In other words, I've never seen any studies that show. And when people take nuts, they essentially get nuts. But I am a great believer that individual foods can affect moods. You know, you come home, let's say that, you know, you have a wonderful piece of salmon and you love salmon. When you're done eating that salmon, you often feel good. And is it just the salmon that you're eating or does it change the endorphins in your body so that you feel much more comfortable and much more lively? And it may be that nuts are just too caloric to you, or it may be that there's something in the nut that affects you. Now, is there one kind of nut that's worse than another nut that you've noticed?
Yes, walnuts.
Mm-hmm.
And walnuts. I like walnuts. Like if I eat other nuts, they don't seem to bother me.
Do you have this passion for walnuts? Are you a passionate walnut eater?
I think it's because my parents always ate them all the time. My dad loves all kinds of nuts and he used to eat them, but I don't know. I think it has affected me more. Like the healthier I get, the more they affect me because I run a lot and.
Uh huh.
And I think I don't know. I crave the nuts. I don't know whether because it's
well,
the fat
but maybe,
in them,
but maybe part of this is sort of not just the nuts. Maybe part of this is essentially going back, as strange as it may seem, to the relationship you had with your father and the fact that when you eat walnuts, you think about your dad, you think about walnuts, you think about home, you think about your family, and that may be where there's an emotional attachment to it. It may be that nuts are really signaling something else that's going on in your brain, and I would kind of look at that. The other thing, of course, is if you're not totally passionate about walnuts, just forget the walnuts and eat other kinds of nuts and fine. I mean, there's pistachios and there are cashews and there are almonds that you can eat. I mean, I love nuts too. Or cut down on the amount of walnuts that you're eating. But I'd kind of look at those other issues.
Yeah, and thank you for calling. Here's my question, Zorba. I eat a lot of nuts. Does this prove or disprove her theory that nuts make you nuts?
Because of who you are. Yes, does it prove or disprove? It proves her theory.
Proves her theory?
Absolutely.
What are you talking about?
There's no doubt about it. Angry every day that you come in. Nuts make you nuts.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. St. Augustine, Florida with us now. Hi.
How are you?
Fine. How can we help?
First, I just want to say that I love your show, and I'm glad you're there for us.
Aren't you nice to say that? Thank you very much. We'll see if we can help you now.
As a denture wearer, I got concerned a little bit when I overheard a conversation. Someone had mentioned that someone they knew was having intestinal problems because of the denture adhesive. And I'm just curious if you've ever heard anything negative about you know, ingesting the adhesive.
The denture adhesive is biologically digestible. I mean, that's exactly what they use. On the other hand, if you look at people with diverticular disease are where there are pockets in the colon. And these pockets essentially can become filled with nuts, for instance, seeds, and then can cause intestinal problems, intestinal discomfort. And it's possible that when you look at somebody who has a denture problem, it may be that that essentially this adhesive was being digested and then getting stuck in these pockets in the colon. So that may have been the issue that was there. I'm not precisely sure, obviously, because I wasn't part of the conversation either. But a denture adhesive is digestible, and that's exactly how the FDA looks at it, because obviously people may swallow part of it, so it has to be something that does not get stuck.
Sure.
But if you've got pockets in your colon, diverticular disease, it may be that one adhesive is different than the other. The other issue is once it gets to the stomach, you may digest it differently. If you've got too much acid in the stomach or you have stress or you've got something called H. pylori, which we've talked about earlier, that has to do with an infection in the stomach, it may get worsened by funny foods that you eat, and a denture adhesive would certainly be a funny food that you would eat or digest. So how long have you had dentures?
It's been about 5 years.
About 5 years. And you've adjusted to them just fine, I take it?
No, I had a difficult time at first, and matter of fact, I had to cut back the roof of it because I had a gag reflex that I could not get rid of, and so I ended up relying on the adhesive more than normal, and wear them during the night, and when I wake up in the morning, I'm a little clogged up with what I think is the adhesive.
Right. So you wear your dentures when you sleep at night?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's good. That's important to keep your face, you know, looking full, because if you don't wear your dentures for a significant part, the face begins to change and the structure begins to change. So you really, it's really much better to wear them all the time.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, 800-462-7413. Zorba, recently we had a caller who needed advice on alternatives to condensed milk because she couldn't have dairy. You suggested boiling soy milk. Well, our listeners chimed in with their two cents, and here are a few suggestions. Hal in Boise, Idaho suggests, instead of boiling the milk, blend it with silken tofu. That will thicken the milk.
Oh, that's a very, very good idea, silken tofu, using essentially the same soy, not the same soy product, but soy, and that would thicken it. Great idea.
Deb in Wisconsin adds, instead of boiling the soy milk, which would take too much time, I add powdered soy milk. For 1 cup of soy milk, I usually add 3 tablespoons of powdered soy milk. This makes regular condensed soy milk not sweetened.
Excellent idea. Right, it's not sweetened. Okay. Another excellent idea. Wow,
these are
great ideas.
Two for two. Zorba so far. For sweetened, we go to Claudia, who is also in Boise, and she suggests combining 3 cups of powdered soy milk, 2/3 of a cup of sugar, 1 cup of boiling water, and 3 tablespoons of oil. Put the ingredients in a blender and process until smooth.
Wow, that's an interesting recipe. That's really good. I kind of like that. We'll put that up on the website. In fact, we'll kind of put them all up on the website.
I was going to say, for those
we'll put them all up on the website. It's a great idea of how to make condensed soy milk. I like these.
You keep your questions, tips, and soy recipes coming. Just send them in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
And do we have a medical myth buster for you and some really interesting research? Coming up here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Again, our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. We'll get to those calls after we take a look at the FDA's decision, Zorba, to take a look at the safety of children's over-the-counter cough and cold remedies.
That's right. cough and cold remedies commonly given to kids, you know, when they are, you know, when, you know, to try to suppress their cough, turn out to be much more dangerous than we really have even thought about. In fact, there have been a couple of deaths that have been linked to cough and cold remedies given to children.
I said children's cold remedies. Are these the same cold remedies that adults take, or are the ones that are prepackaged,
well,
especially for children?
Well, the reality is you hit a very important point. What happens is people think that when cold remedies are over the counter, they can be given willy-nilly, and they don't necessarily even pay attention to what's on the bottle. And we look at some cases, Sudafed, which is something that's commonly given as a decongestant. And in some cases, infants have been given up to 14 times the amount that they should be given for their age and for their weight, because parents have taken and their child has a nose that's runny, and they give them more, and then they give them a little more. And these are actually the problems with these drugs, is the fact that they are drugs. They do not shorten the course of the cold. They're only given for symptomatic relief. And for the most part, kids don't need to have that for symptomatic relief. There are other ways that you can handle
it. It's the pediatricians around the country that are responsible for this FDA review. They have
The pediatricians have gotten on board. The family doctors are following suit. And this is a big industry. When we look at the cough and cold industry, it's actually a $3.5 billion a year industry. So there are a lot of people that are going to essentially get in on this and say, well, do we get rid of all cold remedies, or do we relabel it, or what do we actually do?
Because I was just going to ask, what does an FDA review mean? Could it mean that these things actually come off the counter?
Well, the FDA can say, the answer is yes, first of all. The FDA can say they come off the counter, and we're not going to allow them anymore. The FDA can require warnings on the bottles, or the FDA can change a few things. Sometimes it's just taking a syrupy thing, it's a sweet thing, or it's something that goes down the throat that helps your child, and the medication in it is irrelevant in terms of actually curing anything. So the FDA can wade in and do whatever they want to with it. But it's a big industry. They're not going to wade in willy-nilly.
You know, I understand. The potential danger here, the big one anyway, is for kids really young, like 2-3 years old.
Absolutely. The potential danger is the fact that children under the age of 2 should not be given anything for their cough or cold until you speak to their doctor. That's really the issue. You should do the other things that are simple. You should turn on the vaporizer in the house, ultrasonic vaporizer being absolutely the best. You should make sure that your child is well hydrated. And then you can give acetaminophen or Motrin, which is ibuprofen, you know, for pain or for fever. And in fact, ibuprofen, I think, works a little better because it's every 8 hours, and that's longer than acetaminophen, which is Tylenol. But I would stay away from cough and cold remedies for kids, none for kids under the age of 2.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. 800-462-7413. A listener now, Zorba, in Rogersville, Tennessee. Hi.
How you doing, sir?
Fine. What's up?
I've got a question about these bee pollen products. A lot of the little rural truck stops, like backwoods parts of Pennsylvania and, you know, the little mom-and-pop places, you'll see a lot of them. They have these pamphlets talking about bee pollen and royal jelly and these, you know, diet things are supposed to help your immune system. And I was just wondering if that was true or a modern-day snake oil.
We have a trucker on the phone, huh?
Yes, sir.
Uh-huh. Bee pollen. What's it supposed to do according to the literature? What do they say it's supposed to be good for?
Well, I was listening. I listen to a lot of NPR. And the other day they had some lady on there, and she was talking about how honey was, even though it is still a sugar, it's better than the processed white stuff you get in the Walmart stores. And because she was saying something about how it could actually help people who were alert, had allergies, because the bees get the pollen from all these different plants. And so it's almost like a flu shot. You know, you're getting these antibodies into your system, and it helps your body build the stuff up. And that got me thinking about, you know, the bee pollen. It's supposed to, the guy who is marketing this stuff, they have his, like, 70-year-old mother out cutting grass. I mean, that's what I'm thinking. Is it some kind of modern-day snake oil?
Well, that, you know,
is there any benefit to
it? You know, you bring up some good points. Whenever they show, you know, somebody who's 70 or 75, they're lifting weights, you know, and they're traveling around the world, and they're doing everything. And then you wonder, well, is this stuff real, or am I just looking at stories that people are telling me? There's been a lot of interest over the years in royal jelly. which is made by bees, in bee pollen itself, and whether or not it helps allergies or causes allergies. And there's been a lot of stuff, certainly naturopathic medicine and homeopathic medicine, a lot of people who have actually looked at these to see if there's anything there. First of all, I don't think there's any evidence that it causes a difference in allergies. You'd like to think of it as a shot that you basically take by eating, but it really does not work that way, and there's just no evidence that it actually decreases allergies at all. And whether or not it makes you feel better, well, I think it fits within that sort of supplement, the sort of supplement mentality that some people have. Some people believe that supplements are useful, like they give them energy. Lots of Americans take supplements and they feel better, and other people say, I'm not going to take any supplements. I don't really think they do anything. There's no evidence that bee pollen is different from others, with one exception. It's usually very expensive. Mm. Bee pollen and royal jelly are outrageously expensive supplements for the most part. So on the whole, I say if you're going to take a supplement, you know, you've got to know something about it. And I don't think there's any scientific evidence in this. So answering your question, is it modern day snake oil? In one way, yes, because there's nothing there. I think that you're absolutely correct.
He mentioned that he heard on NPR that honey is better for you than sugar.
Well,
it was on public radio.
That must be true. That's right. Anything on public radio must be true. You know, honey is a sugar. It's a very, you know, it's a sugar, but it's not refined like beet sugar or white sugar that we normally have. And, of course, it's made by bees. So there are a lot of people who believe that it really is healthier for you when you use it as a sweetener. And I'm one of those people who I think that honey has certainly a more healthful veneer. Once again, in moderation, if you have too much honey, of course, it leads to obesity and cavities and all that other stuff.
Yeah.
And certainly is better than high fructose corn syrup that I think basically is almost addictive and causes lots of obesity in our society.
1-800-462-7413. Well, Zorba, let's get to our medical myth buster now. Our myth today is one that you and I and our technical director will reluctantly relate to. It has to do with the old saying that male pattern baldness, sorry, Brad, is inherited through our mothers. So, Zorba, can we blame our mothers for this, or is it a myth?
This happens to be true. It is not a myth. And for years, physicians really weren't sure, but there's new information that indeed it may be the case, because scientists in Germany have isolated a gene variant from families where at least two brothers had early hair loss and at least two brothers did not have early hair loss. So they looked at these different families and they looked at the culprit, and it appears that there is an androgen receptor gene. Now, androgens are responsible for male hair loss. Eunuchs don't get male pattern hair loss. Did you know that?
No.
Eunuchs don't get male pattern hair loss. You don't see many eunuchs these days.
How do you know?
But it was that's true. You wouldn't necessarily know, would you?
Unless you're at the gym or
that's
something.
That's right. But eunuchs don't get male pattern hair loss because they don't make androgen, because basically the testicles are destroyed in some way. But that's because, turns out, testosterone essentially is necessary for male pattern hair loss. Now, it appears that this androgen receptor gene is on the X chromosome. We get the Y from the dads, if mm-hmm. you're a guy, and you get the X from the moms. So that means the X is this androgen receptor Whoa. Variant is coming from the mom. It's activated by the testosterone, which essentially is activated by the Y chromosome, but the mom appears to possibly be responsible for male pattern.
Why do you add the possibly? Because it sounds definitive.
Well, it's because it's not definitive. They found the receptor. There may be other receptors, but at this time I would say it's not a myth. Mom's responsible. Go blame mom. That's it. Mom is responsible. Go blame her.
And then send us a myth buster you'd like us to bust. Just send it in an email with the subject titled Myth Buster. Make sure to send that email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
That toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. And a listener now, Zorba in College Station, Texas. Hi.
Hi, yes, thank you so much for taking my call.
We appreciate you calling. How can we help?
Yes, my skin has been itching severely for about a month now. There is no visible rash, maybe an isolated bump here or there. I went to doctors about a month ago, and he told me that it was probably winter's itch. I was kind of alarmed by this, considering we don't have much of a winter's here in Texas. So I was, and my face is completely unafflicted. He said, well, your face naturally produces oils, which might be a reason why your face doesn't dry out. So since then, I've been using various types of lotion, hand creams, practically saturating my skin in the morning and in the evening before I go to bed, and it seems to not
make a difference.
Subsiding the uncomfortableness, I guess.
It does not seem to make a difference. Now, what kind of soap, when you shower, when you bathe, do you use?
I use soft soap, body wash. It's a body wash soap.
Okay. So let me tell you a little bit about soap, because soap is important. First of all, in our society, we wash all the time. In other societies like France, they don't wash every day. I mean, they don't shower every day. They don't wash every day. They don't like the feeling of it. We like the feeling of skin without oil on it. That's when we feel clean. In France, they are clean, but they like the feeling of oil. And so, and they do other things, like they don't wear deodorant in France and other things, because they consider that, of course, to be a natural smell, and they like that. In our society, we try to get rid of our smells and make ourselves squeaky clean, getting rid of the oil. That's the problem. And in the wintertime, when you get rid of the oil on your in your skin and on your skin, when winter tends to be just a drier time, whether it's cold or not, it's just a drier time across the country, you tend to itch more. So one way to get rid of the itching is to not dry out your skin as much. That means when you're using a soap, you want to use a non-drying soap. And the body wash you're using may be responsible for a lot of this. So I would go to something like Dove, which is more of a soapless cleanser. Lever 2000 may also work. It's a bar soap. Dove also comes in a pump. That's what I would do. I would immediately go to something like that. And I would shower every other day versus every day.
Okay.
If you shower less and you spend less time in the shower and the shower isn't as hot, all those things will help the itchy skin. And then you'll find your groove. Now, for some people, it's only a soap. For other people, in the wintertime, they shower every other day or every third day. In the summer, they're fine because of the air. The third thing is, when you sleep in your bedroom, you should have a humidifier in the bedroom.
Okay.
You spend about a third of your time, rather, 8 hours a day or 7 or 6 hours a day in your room. Humidify the bedroom so the bedroom is moist when you're sleeping, and your skin will feel better. And get an ultrasonic humidifier. They cost a little more. They last longer. They're better molecules. They're smaller little bubbles that essentially go into the air, and they're cheaper to run.
Okay, well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Yep, you're welcome.
You.
Good luck.
Call. Thanks
Good
a lot. 800-462-7413. And a listener now, Zorba, in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dr. Zorba.
How can we help?
Well, a couple of weeks from now, I'm going on a Caribbean cruise,
and
I'm really excited about it. This isn't my first one, but I'm a little worried now because you know how it is with vacations. You remember the good parts and you forget the bad.
Right.
Every time I've gone in the past, I'm remembering now, I've had a lot of trouble with seasickness. And I've had the patch behind my ear and taken the Dramamine, but it makes me sleepy. And I even missed the muster, the lifeboat drill, and I got in a lot of trouble on my last cruise.
Oh, what kind of trouble did you get into?
Oh, I heard my name on the overhead intercom, you know, me and about four other passengers.
No, how did they know? They don't take everybody's name at those musters.
Somehow they knew. It must have been a boat with about over 3,000 people, and I heard my name.
So you got public humiliation for not doing that silly life jacket.
The name is Muster?
Yeah, you go to my... Wait, you don't know anything about the Navy, do you?
No, Muster. Is that where you get past the muster?
Yeah.
What's the muster?
Well, you get together and do something.
Everybody has to go out on the deck, and you go to your assigned lifeboat.
And you stand around with your life jacket on and hear a boring lecture, and then you go back and have fun.
Right. But I was laying in bed, grabbing the sheets and afraid to move. You
and
know?
They were calling you and saying, Where is she?
I figured they have to come and get me. But, I'm looking forward to these wonderful meals I'm going to be getting. And but in the past, what I've resorted to is a lot, taking over the bread basket and even stuffing my purse with bread, taking it back to... It seems like I have to have bread in my stomach all the time to fight this nausea.
Sure.
Can you help me out?
Well, the treatments for this generally are the scope patch. Now, some people can tolerate two patches. One patch won't work, two patches will work.
Oh.
So, and what you would have to do, though, is talk to your doctor, and I would try it before. It may make you a little bit tired, but often caffeine will, you know, will go to the other side of that. But some people will actually tolerate, they need a double dose. And that would be the first thing I would do. The other issue is, because Dramamine will tend to make you tired, is I would try, and you can mix them together, I would try over-the-counter generic Claritin. Now, it's not as effective as Dramamine, but it still may help take the edge off of things. And you can take 1 to 3 tablets a day of that. It's a 24-hour pill. And then, if that doesn't work, then you add the Dramamine to it. But as you know, it's better to treat seasickness before it occurs. I mean, that's the real issue.
Oh.
So do you put the patch on when you get on the boat?
I think I put it on like 24 hours before.
Yeah,
ship.
Because that's
ship, not
on
boat.
The ship. I'm sorry.
The lifeboats are on the cruise ship.
Ship. I'll just keep on saying that. Ship, not boat. Ship, not boat. I've got it in my mind. But getting back to the ship, you want to put it on 24 hours before, and then I think I would take Claritin with it automatically. What I would do is I would put on a double patch. If you tolerate it, I would keep on the double patch. If it makes you too sleepy, only go to a single. But I would take one Claritin twice a day. That won't make you sleepy, and that may help take the edge off of things. You know, there's no perfect drug for this. There's just no perfect drug. Now, why do you put yourself through this just for food? I mean, why do you put yourself through nausea on a boat? She said she's looking forward to the meals. Why don't you just go out to a good restaurant?
What ports are you going to?
What ports?
Yeah.
Eastern Caribbean, going to Cozumel and Belize.
Yeah, but you're talking about the meals on the boat. I mean, why don't you just go to ship? I'll get it straight one of these days. Ship, not boat. Why don't you just go to New York City and go from one restaurant to another? It's terra firma and you won't get seasick.
Well, there's something fun about those, you know, sunsets on the boat.
Absolutely.
The ocean and all.
Yeah,
so.
Anyway, have a good time and don't get seasick.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. And I hope she stays away from that. What's that virus that they get on?
Norwalk. We don't even mention it.
We mentioned it. We were on a cruise. Yeah. We both got it. Yeah. It was a terrible cruise, and we're never doing it again.
Really?
And on that note, thanks a lot, Zorba, for being here.
Stay well, Tom.
For a copy of this week's recipe and all things Zorba, visit us on the web
at zorbapastor.org.
And don't forget, you can bug Adam day and night at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and is produced by Adam Friedrich. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Gigi Holland fills your recipe requests. And Brad Kohlberg fills out our staff as the technical director. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you're with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
For a copy of today's show, call the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0317Z. To buy Zorba's book, The Longevity Code, your personal prescription for a longer, sweeter life, or to pick up a copy of Zorba's Heart Healthy Cookbook, just go to our website at zorbapastor.org.